if you were to organize your content in such a way that you go as granular as you can with learning objectives, an example would be addition of single digit whole numbers. You know, it can be as granular as that. Then you can start collecting huge amounts of data of what the learner masters and what his level of mastery is or understanding for each one of these little granular learning concepts. And that then enables you to really draw pretty accurate sort of learner profile to understand where they might need more help, remediation, support, and you can really use that your advantage to help the learners with the learning outcomes.
The Digital to Learn podcast is dedicated to exploring both what's new and what's good in the use of technology in teaching and learning.
Our mission is to have the best minds sitting in front of our microphones sharing evidence-based strategies for digital teaching and learning.
Digital to Learn is brought to you by the Center for Learning and Innovation at Indiana Wesleyan University.
Thank you for joining us. And now, the Digital to Learn podcast.
Welcome to the Digital to Learn podcast. I'm Tiffany Snyder, and I'm here with my co-host, Brad Garner. Hi, Brad.
Hello, hello. We're excited to have Melody Lang with us today on Digital to Learn. Melody is co-founder and COO of Mindstone, a learning platform that provides anyone, anywhere in the world with the tools, confidence, and motivation to take ownership of their own learning. Melody is also founder and advisor at MPA Education, an advisory and investment company dedicated to the future of learning and work. Before establishing MPA, Melody was CEO at Invensa, an ed tech investment company, and director of partnerships and implementations at Newton, the world's leading adaptive learning technology provider. She was Newton's first international employee when the London office was opened in 2013, overseeing a growing number of partnerships with major European publishers. She started her career as an engineer and research scientist in marine engineering and later in the aerospace industry. Melody holds a master's degree in mathematics with honors from UPMC Paris 6 and an engineering doctorate from Imperial College London. Welcome, Melody, to the Digital to Learn podcast.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
And we did a bit of research on Melody. She's actually joining us today from London. And from what we've gathered, she has traveled quite a bit. She's lived in different places, and our get to know you questions are focused completely on that. So I'll kick it off. Melody, what is the favorite place that you've lived?
I think that's going to be an easy one to answer. I actually lived for a whole year in Rome, Italy. Mm. And that was quite something. I was 19 years old. Wow. And the idea is that, you know, with a program called Erasmus, so at the time I was a student in Paris, reading math at uni. And it was my third year, and I could pick one other university in a European country to go and study abroad for a full year. And for the little story, because I was speaking German already that I had learned in school, I thought, well, let's go to Berlin. And then my mother looked at the list of countries and cities. She's like, are you going to read math in German? What's wrong with you? Like, are you really my daughter? And she's like, and she points out and said, Rome. What's wrong with Rome? And so I'm like, okay, maybe you've got a point. And I just said, but I don't know how to speak Italian. It's like, don't worry, you'll learn it. And so here I went to live in Rome for a whole year. And that was tremendous with, you know, my little motorino going around the streets. It was a tremendous year. But just I would say that today, my favorite place is London. And that's where I currently Aww. Live. I really adore it here. I've got two parks walking distance from home. And my children's school is also down the house. So everything is super easy wow. and convenient and a lot of international friends. So, yes.
What was the best thing about living in Rome?
I would say being taken out by charming Italian guys for dinner. For them, it was novelty. You know, the Belgian girl who just like shows up, it's like, oh, yes. So they were, you know, coming down the house and picking me up with their car. And I think it was also the freedom of, you know, going to Venice for the weekend and then to Tuscany by the sea to have, you know, that whole discovery also around.
And at age 19, that just sounds amazing.
Yes, it was magical, I have to say. And just to complete the whole, you know, vision, it was like a year of holiday because, you know, attendance was not mandatory at all the courses and lessons. So you could just, you know, kind of pass with doing it your own way. Just, you know, being flexible with your own, you know, time. And that gave me a lot of, freedom to also explore the life there.
Yeah.
So if London and Rome were your favorite places to live, what have been some of your favorite places to visit?
I went to Tokyo to visit. The idea was that I had friends who were living there at the time. So I had somewhere to go to and meet my friends. And then because I traveled with a Belgian friend of mine, from there, we went to Kyoto. We saw the cherry blossoms and also went to Naoshima. I don't know if you know Naoshima. It's an island and it's fully dedicated to contemporary art. It's like a living museum.
Wow.
Wow.
It's out of this world. So that was quite something.
Awesome.
What are three things that you cannot travel without?
Okay. The first thing that really comes to mind is earplugs. I think that's a lifesaver, but a lifesaver in any occasion. I think you should never, ever leave your house without earplugs, or even inside your house, you know, if you're sleeping next to someone who snores, or if you're taking your child to a birthday party, I can tell you earplugs are very, very, very helpful as well. And then when you travel, of course, you know, the plane, the train, all of that rumbling noise. I mean, that's just, for me, lifesaver. The second thing I would say, I would not go anywhere without a scarf or some pashmina, a bit bigger than a scarf, because I'm someone who's always cold for some reason. And I think that's also something I need to have. And also, you know, if it's large enough, use it as a cushion or, you know, to stay warm. And that would be that. The third one, I think I would go back to the basics and I would actually combine them into one item, which is my glasses, you know, as you can see on my nose, glasses, my phone and headphones. So you can listen to an audiobook or just be in your little world.
Very good.
Our listeners can't see, but Brad also cannot travel without his glasses, except his are always on his head, not on his eyes. So
I thought about that when I said it. I'm like, Melody, you're on the podcast here. What?
It's okay.
I have a confession to make, though. I do wear my glasses on the top of my head, but there have been many occasions when I've walked around saying, "Where are my glasses? Where are my glasses?" And then end up putting on a second pair. Unaware that I have a first pair on my forehead.
So. Yeah, that's a good one.
So let's get serious, Tiffany. Ask some serious questions.
Serious questions. Okay, well, instantly I was drawn to Melody's diverse background. So we've got mechanical engineering, angel investing, ed tech leadership, and it's just makes anyone curious, I think. How did you go from one thing to the next?
Very good question. And I did realize that one day when I saw my LinkedIn profile, I'm like, Melody, this is all over the place, you know? What are you? And actually, there is a story that, you know, is going to join up every single thing. So that's what I'm going to tell you about. So what happens? Well, end of secondary school, you know, you can already specialize. For me, it was a no-brainer, science, mathematics. So I went for the baccalaureate scientific section. Great. From there, okay, what do I want to read at uni? Well, I enjoy mathematics. Okay, let's go for that. And here I go at uni studying math. Did a master's degree, so 4 years. And then with all of these mathematics, I'm like, what am I going to do with all of this? And I thought, wait, I've got a passion for sailing. What about combining both? and applying, yes, because what I forgot to say is that with my mathematics, I had always kept a module on fluid mechanics, which I enjoyed very much. So it's all about, you know, going towards what I enjoyed. And while my mathematics, I could not really see, I mean, find joy in applying them to finance, I could really see an interest in applying them to physics, mechanics, and more of the scientific side of it. So I thought, why not? So my first job after my master's in math was to join a yacht design company in the south of France. So I chose south of France, not Brittany, for obvious reasons. I wanted to, you know, be in a sunny place. And I have applied my mathematics to, you know, solve all the engineering, you know, challenges around yacht design. So we're talking aerodynamics, hydrodynamics, and stability, predict the velocity of the boat and things like that. So I had a lot of fun. From there, I thought, wait, I also want to be able to draw them. And so that's where I went for a yacht design degree for correspondence. So I could also have fun on AutoCAD and do the designs. Then I moved, yeah. And what I'm grateful for, and I need to mention that, is having a mother who's always said two things when she raised us. She said, do whatever you enjoy doing. So it was all about, you know, enjoying and having choices around what we enjoy doing. And then she said, aim to be financially independent. Mm-hmm. So we had those two little, you know, sort of voices in our heads. And I'm very grateful for that, because that's how I could really go on this path, doing things I enjoyed, but also making a living out of what I enjoyed doing. So then from there, so I was in the south of France working in the boat industry indeed, and then moved to London for a man I had met and ended up marrying, I need to say. But in London, I couldn't find the job that I was after in that specific industry. Yeah, you know, I had to be in Southampton, UK, I mean, by the coast, and I moved to London to be with him, so not to commute to some other place. So I broadened my search back to civil engineering. And that is when I joined an engineer consultant who then was hired by Kinetic. Kinetic is the research entity for the Ministry of Defense in the UK. And because he was very loyal to me, he had me meet them. And that's where I just said, are you sponsoring PhDs by any chance? And they said, yes. Yes, actually, we are. And we are looking for a candidate. And you seem to have the right skill set. And here I was starting a PhD in mechanical engineering, because I thought, wait, are you telling me you're going to pay me to have an additional degree on my CV? That's pretty cool. Let's do this. And so that's how I did that, while I was also having two children. And then after my PhD in mechanical engineering, I thought, what's next? And that's where I took a step back and realized that I had a strong, strong passion for education. And the whole transformation the industry is going through, I wanted to take part in that transformation. So as a true nerd, I did map the whole landscape. And I was like, okay, where can I add value? Where can I, you know, have a role to play? And so from publishers to, you know, institutions. And then I'm like, wait a second, is there such a thing as EdTech? Yes, there is. That's a very good fit to my profile. And so I settled on EdTech. And at that moment in time, the one company that was making a lot of noise in the space was Newton. Mm-hmm. They had raised over $150 million, headquartered in New York. And I was the first hire outside of the US to join the London team. I stayed with them for 4 years. It was the most tremendous learning experience, you know, working for such a company. And from there, I was then approached by a fund who wanted someone with industry expertise and network to set up their entity dedicated to EdTech. Mm-hmm. So I did warn them. I'm like, do you realize my mathematics were never applied to finance, right? And then they said, oh, don't worry, we have enough finance people here, and early stage investment is not rocket science, anyways. So mm-hmm. you can. And I enjoyed that. I was up to the challenge, anyways, and did that and set up. Actually, did that for them for a year, and then set up my own investment entity called MPA Education. We've got a portfolio of 10 startups dedicated to the future of learning and work. And that what I enjoyed the most there was to be extremely hands-on, super close to founders, help them grow and scale their companies, introduce them to the right people, connecting the dots. And so when my LPs said, well, can you scale this? Can you structure it, formalize it as a proper fund? And, you know, we'll put more money into it. I kind of froze because I'm like, wait, that's going to make of me a fund manager. And I'm not sure this is what I want to do. That would take me away and it would put a distance between me and the founders. I really wanted to be very close to them. And that's when I realized I was more of an operator than an investor. And because I was advising Mindstone for the last year, then the team said, well, join us as co-founder. And it became so obvious this was the right move and the right thing to do, to be back as an operator, really hands-on, and co-found Mindstone with the team.
So how do you get closer to the founders than becoming a founder, right? That's what happened.
Exactly. No, I have to say, if I was to start anything in the space, it would have been exactly what they were up to. So I'm like, okay, I'm in. So, yeah.
I'm thinking we start a new podcast called The Adventures of Melody Lang.
Right?
Because I'm also suspecting that if we were today to say, let's get together again in 5 years, you would have a whole nother range of things that you've done or thought about or moved to over that period of 5 years.
It's not impossible. So yes, yeah, let's keep that thought.
When you were with Newton, you were in the early stages of adaptive learning and the level at which that has and will hopefully have a greater impact on higher education. How did you see that evolve over time?
What was extremely frustrating, I have to say, at Newton is that I knew what was going on behind the scene. And you know what we would call the black box? Nobody knows what's, you know, behind an adaptive learning model. Well, I can tell you that Newton, it was pretty sophisticated, real-time algorithms. And it was very frustrating that someone with a static decision tree, as in you get this right, you go there, you get this wrong, you go there, would also be called adaptive learning. So to answer your question, the evolution is that it's going from a very simplistic model that is extremely static and that is something called the decision tree to extremely sophisticated, refined algorithms that are, you know, in real time and that would also get refined over time thanks to all of the machine learning happening and the data going through the models. So that was very clear and quite frustrating that obviously there was not enough communication on the difference between the two. That was that. And the advantage I have really witnessed and seen is that, well, the beauty at Newton is that obviously any of the publishers who owned the content could leverage our technology in the way they wanted to build those adaptive products. Mm-hmm. And over time, we could really see what was best practices in terms of developing those products to a point that actually Newton came up with their own product called Alta. But I have to say, I think it's about keeping the learner engaged. So you have to, I don't know if you're familiar with the zone of proximal development. Uh-huh. So it's really keeping him or her in that space where they're challenged enough to, you know, kind of learn and go outside the comfort zone, but at the same time, you know, not too difficult so that we lose them and they drop off. So that is what adaptive learning can be very good at doing, is fine-tuning this and keeping the learner in that space, in that zone. So I think that's an interesting thing. Now, what is really, really impressive is that if you were to organize your content in such a way that you go as granular as you can with learning objectives, an example would be addition of single digit whole numbers. You know, it can be as granular as that. Then you can start collecting huge amounts of data of what the learner masters and what his level of mastery is or understanding for each one of these little granular learning concepts. And that then enables you to really draw pretty accurate sort of learner profile to understand where they might need more help, remediation, support, and you can really use that to your advantage to help the learners, with the learning outcomes. So I would also now just turn towards the teacher who would have access to tremendous dashboards. Imagine you're teaching a class of 300 students, or well, whatever, small or big the class. What I'm saying is super difficult to understand who is doing, how, on what. So instead of they pass a test every 2 days, so you can assess them and understand, then it's quite tricky. But if they are learning constantly on a continuous, basis on these sort of adaptive learning platforms, all the data that's being gathered can then be used into teacher dashboards, who can then pinpoint who is struggling on what, how can they modify their lessons or classes to make sure they address those gaps and really point their students in the right direction. So I think it gives them a lot of intel on how their classes are doing with their learning. So it can really be a tremendous advantage for teachers as well, especially that then they might save time to focus on what they do best, actually, which is motivation, helping students learn how to use those facts and knowledge.
Thank you all for joining us for this series of Digital to Learn. We're going to be back next week with Melody to talk more about Mindstone. If you would like to access more resources regarding today's talk, you can learn more at digitaltolearn.com or on Twitter at digitaltolearn or on LinkedIn. Thanks, everyone. See you next week.
Thank you for joining us on Digital to Learn.
If you enjoyed this podcast, there are three things we ask you to do. 1, come back and join us again. 2, tell your friends about us. And 3, give us a positive ranking on your favorite podcast platform.
Digital to Learn is brought to you by the Center for Learning and Innovation at Indiana Wesleyan University.
It's a digital world.
Always keep learning.